This week, this is the conclusion of a week, our first week here, of teaching sort of what might be called a survey course on healthcare. And healthcare, not as a standalone subject, but under this paragraph that we put up on the board here. And if you take a look at it, I know it's hard to read, so I'll just read it through with you, that the central ethic of Christian love, agape, has caused our religion to be the leader in taking a holistic, a whole approach to the quality of life. And thus, we think, individuals, congregations, and communities where Christians live, and the governments they support, should reflect not a standoff, thus not no longer strangers, not a standoff, distant, or stranger relationship with those in need of health care, but one of concern and compassion. And so that's the general premise that we've been operating under all week. And as a result, we've talked about access to care, we've talked about quality of care, we've talked about theology of health care, we've talked about, at the request of our people, and we hope that you'll do this again this week, because next week, Lee and I are going to split off and we're going to do a separate, we team taught this week, you might call it, and next week we're going to do individual things. And for those of you who are new, look on the kiosk and you'll see when we appear and what our subjects are. But we've tried to give this survey, and we've tried to put together a team teaching thing to give the survey approach to health care. Tonight is the conclusion of the first week then, and I say it's the conclusion, and we switched things around because as we related to the people who came to these classes this week, there were a bunch of people who were leaving today who wanted to talk last night about long-term care. And we had quite a number of people who came, and so we did a survey again type presentation on long-term care and its financing and all of those kinds of ins and outs of long-term care. So this week, as you come to healthcare sessions, whether they be Leah's or be mine, we're going to ask you to participate and to speak up, because we have a body of knowledge that we can cover, but we can also, we hope, meet your needs. And so if we hear by the end of the week that there's some particular thing that you're interested in that we have not scheduled or have not covered, we're happy to adapt ourselves to that. And maybe as the week comes to a close next this coming week, we may change some of the subject. So with that, our subject tonight is who pays for healthcare? We want to be concerned about the payment mechanisms. We want to be concerned that you know and contribute to the knowledge of all of us. But Lee is going to lead this and talk about payment mechanisms for healthcare.
Inherent in payment mechanisms, it could be really, really boring. This could be like just a lot of laying everything out. And I'm going to do the best to get an understanding of you throughout how much you know of various things, how much you know of Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance. So I'll make sure that I'll give you as much information as you want. We can back up and just talk about a few of the issues under each. But I will give you the basis of each, or at least talk about what's going on today, so that everybody understands how things are getting paid for. One of the first things I'd like to find out just is whether people have an understanding of how large our healthcare system is, and that is, what do people think the amount is that we spend on healthcare in our country a year? Anybody know?
Tens of trillions.
3 trillion.
No, that's much.
40 billion.
We just crossed the 1 trillion mark. Okay? To give you a perspective, if this is a perspective, I don't know if any of us have a perspective of the solar system, but if you lined up a dollar bills, 1 trillion of them would go past the sun. So every day, or every year, we're spending an inordinate amount of money on healthcare, and this is growing. One of the things I think that is good to get an idea is, you can say 1 trillion, but does that really mean anything to us unless we know what 1 trillion is compared to the rest of our national budget? And you hear a lot in the news, people talk about the gross domestic product, or basically how much is our total spending for everything in our country. Well, for instance, I can tell you that $27 billion was spent in 1960 of our budget. Well, that doesn't really say anything. What
when you
always
say budget, you mean of our total spending?
Of our total spending.
Not government budget.
Yeah, of our total spending. You're right. Of our total spending in, of the nation. Well, you say 27 billion, but the important thing to know is, as a percentage, healthcare in 1960 was 5%. All right. Well, in 1980, healthcare was 9%, and it was 247 billion. So you have to see both the absolute number and the number of our percentage of our GDP. Well, in 1994, when it was just below 1 trillion, it was 950 billion, we're up to 14% of our GDP. So this is a growth rate that not only is staying as a percentage about normal, in essence, we are spending more and more and more money on healthcare. Well, why does this matter? What difference does it make how much money we spend on healthcare? Yeah.
Question. Sorry, I don't have an answer.
Okay.
Question, how much of that is related to the demographics of the society that is getting older?
That is relevant. There's no doubt about it that our financing policies, our programs like Medicare and Medicaid have contributed greatly to the amount of money that we spend. In 1960, we didn't have these social financing programs. We didn't have Medicare and Medicaid. One of the reasons why healthcare was only 5% of our GDP. Absolutely. And as the population ages, we most likely will spend more. However, what difference does it make? What if we spend 30%? It's an industry. We're employing people. We're putting people to work and manufacturing everything from crutches to biotechnology. So it's not just a industry of sickness, but this is an industry. I mean, anybody you talk to, there's somebody has 1 in 7 people. That's 1/7 of our GDP. So technically, 1 in 7 people could potentially be working in the healthcare industry. Why are people concerned about this?
One of the reasons the dollar percentage has grown is the ever-increasing cost, partly related to technology that costs more than just the country doctor. And as healthcare costs more, then that may limit access to a segment of our population.
Well, that's a problem of, you're right, that's a problem of increasing costs per person, and it also contributes, as you said, things like aging population. But the reason people get very uptight or upset about the fact that our healthcare is slowly eating up more and more and more of the money we spend as a nation is because it's at a loss of other things. The more we spend on healthcare, the less money we have to do other things. So the more our government or the more our private insurers spend for keeping people well or waiting until, in essence, in our country, waiting until people are very sick and then spending a lot of money, is that it takes away money from the classic mentality of leisure activities. You spend more money of your paycheck for your healthcare, well, you have less money for other things, buying a house, whatever. So the reason economists and planners in the legislation and everyone are trying to curb this growth is because although it's employing a lot of people, it's at the detriment of other things, and we eventually have to get a grasp on this. One of the things I want to warn you about, too, is that as people tell you, oh, it's out of control, like Medicare is going to go bankrupt by 2001, or oh, at the rate we're going, at the growth rate we're going, if we continue to have our GDP as a percentage of our healthcare grow and grow and grow, we're going to have half of our national spending be spent on healthcare. Well, most likely that's just not true. You just can't imagine that to be happening. Something we would go bankrupt in that case. We would have no money to spend on defense, on all these other private companies. Everybody would be spending their money on healthcare. So when you see those are a little bit of scare tactics, and they're probably to get people motivated to think about some things. But most likely, you're not going to see the growth rate continuing at this pace.
I have a question.
Sure.
I don't know if anyone has the answer. Maybe you don't either. But do you know how the U.S. numbers compare to, say, a country with a socialized medicine program? Belgium or Germany.
That's a perfect lead-in. Thank you. You're a plant, right?
I lived in Belgium for a while, so I'm just curious.
If this is the gross domestic product of any nation, okay, and this is how much money people spend on health, so this is the health dollars, in almost all countries, everyone falls along those lines. All right. So in essence, as they become a wealthier country, they spend more money on healthcare. third world countries spend the majority of their money on public health initiatives, things like sanitation, immunizations. They have less money to spend, but they try to hit as big a population. But healthcare is sometimes considered almost a luxury good, in that the more money you have, the better insured you are, the more money you'll spend and access the system. So almost everyone is somewhere along this line. We, on the other hand, are here. Okay? This is what everyone, this is the concern. This is what people say. We've got to get back to some sort of rational, you know, spending. Now, the next one in line is, I think if I'm not mistaken, is Canada. And we right now are about 14%. Ever since Canada has implemented their single payer system, it's stopped their growth a lot faster. They were somewhere around 8 to 9%. Britain, I'm picking countries that have similar demographics to us. So Britain is about 4%, and Japan is somewhere around 5%. Yes?
Okay, so the question begs to be asked, what is the difference between us and the mean?
Well, I'll get to that. So yeah, perfectly different. Actually, what do you think? You actually mentioned one of the things that drives our healthcare higher than anything else, and that is our love of technology. We love technology, so we will apply the latest and the greatest technology to any ill that you can imagine, one. Two, we also are the pioneers. People learn from us. People train here, physicians and technologists and professionals train here. So we often are spending a tremendous amount of money on research and development. There's a lot of criticism in that we are not making people share the cost of that. And yet you can't imagine our culture being any different. We obviously want to be the leaders and we have the innovation. So a lot of times we spend a tremendous amount of upfront money and then we kindly or through training programs train others and send them back. So that's expensive.
Yep. We've also got uncontrolled profits in the health industry where there's some costs that some hospital situations where they may be going bankrupt, mm-hmm. small communities where they don't have what they need. We also, you know, Tylenol paid for itself how many times now since it was created?
Absolutely.
Versus a doctor's wage in some of these foreign countries being at a set level of wage. Mm-hmm. Here, that profit motivation is different. And we attract some of the best doctors in the world because of it, because you can get rich as well.
Undoubtedly. We, by the way, when you look at these percentages, we have the most amalgamated system than any other country, and we are the most private. Other countries just cannot understand that we operate in such a private for-profit mentality, and that also contributes. Again, you can't really point your finger and blame any one of these reasons. They all contribute. So people have sort of pet peeves and things they like to attack, but really it's all of these combined. Our demographics are changing, both as we age and as we continue to bring in new immigrants. And so we have both sides of the story. As our uninsured population grows, that contributes to the amount of money that the other people are picking up. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about some of the private insurance issues.
On behalf of the drug companies, I'd like to say that profit motive has caused them to come out with some pretty neat drugs in the past.
I want to agree with you on that. The interesting thing is it takes, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere between about $250 and $300 million these days to bring out a single new drug. That's research, development, all the FDA testing it goes through. Well, I don't know what the odds are, but for one drug that makes it, many, many, many fail. So the profits that you reap on one drug are making up for all the lost innovation on the failed drugs. So although
it also is part of the safety too that we have in this country that may not exist. You know, in California, we hear about people going down to Mexico all the time to get drugs that are working there. Well, you know, 10, 15 years down the road, that may turn out to be a very unsafe drug. I think of the thalidomide that was used back a couple of generations ago, and what that did to people, because it was not released yet, as I understand it, in this country, but other countries had one out there.
Right.
I was going to just add one point back to technology. I'm from Cleveland, and we have two hospitals, one's a Cleveland Clinic and the other one's University Hospitals. They're within about two blocks of each other. I mean, the headquarters, mm-hmm. but they span, I mean, just, I don't know what it is, like 1 or 2 square miles of hospitals. I mean, just a huge conglomerate. But they're in direct competition on some of these mm-hmm. brand new scanners and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They cost just millions and millions of dollars each. Mm-hmm. And they each want one.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
that's
amazing.
Yeah, their patients want them to have them.
That's a subset, yeah. in essence, yeah. of the technology component. For instance, Canada has one MRI per, I don't even know. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like per half a province. You know, mm-hmm. there's, I'm gonna get killed. Is there 4 or 5 provinces?
Ten.
Oh, I'm thinking of the lower. I knew I was gonna get killed for that. They expect people to be referred and travel. We have, like, I think, like 13 to 14 MRIs in Los Angeles. I mean, and it's built on competition. I mean, that's exactly what's going on. So you can imagine.
And you have to wait in Canada.
And you have to wait. And that's also one of the reasons why Britain has a low percentage, whatever. There's long queuing lines. And you know what they do? They cross the borders and they come here for health care and they pay for it.
The Canadians,
that's right.
Northern tier, the most patients are the Canadian patients that come across the border because of that way. We had a visiting pastor preaching who was at the theological seminary, and she told the story of having moved from one parish to another in Canada. Just before she moved, she was diagnosed with cancer. Because she moved into another parish, she had to wait for the treatment.
Right.
She couldn't get what she knew she needed,
right.
having just, you know, moved from one area to another. She came across the border.
Right. So, moving on a little bit, I want to clear up with some terminology that might help you get a good understanding of when people talk about healthcare costs. The generally accepted term these days is expenditures, because it's important to recognize what we're spending for healthcare. Costs are really a production, like how much does it cost you to make this pencil versus what is its price? And those are two very different concepts. And so in the healthcare world, it's very bizarre. It's like airline tickets. You know, you sit down next to somebody on an airline and there's no way that you both paid the same amount. It's just random. It seems random to everybody. Well, healthcare is a little bit the same way, in that depending on the insurance contract you have, whether it's private, whether it's Medicare, whether it's Medicaid, whether it's Aetna, whether it's Blue Cross, it doesn't matter. Everybody has a different price. And so price means really nothing, first of all. And then price is usually set overly high so that everyone can say, well, I'm going to give you a 20% discount because, you know, you signed up with our favorite people. So then who knows? I mean, then you're getting it at a discounted price. But really what the hospitals and what healthcare providers do is they sit back and they say, how much does it cost me to provide this service? And then the government and private insurers and other people sit back and they tally up their numbers and they say, what are we spending for healthcare? What are our expenditures? So when we talk about we spend $1 trillion, that's what we spend on healthcare. That's not what it costs us to provide it and the profits in that function, okay? Without drawing too much on the board, I think that there's an important distinction to be made about where the money comes from and where the money goes to. So if this is where the money comes from, how much do you think the United States government, federal and state, pays for expenditures now that you have the terminology, for healthcare, percentage-wise?
50%?
40%?
30%? 35%?
65%? 20%?
Sold! It's actually about 50%. And more specifically, Medicare, he's gonna call this MCARE, is 20%. These figures are a little bit old too. We talked about this in a previous session. Our figures are always a little outdated because it takes a long time to get all the information and the data collected from everyone else. Medicaid, which is growing rapidly, is about 22%. And other government is about 14%, something like that, maybe a little bit less.
Does that include the research at the national institutes?
Yeah, this is just
in Champa, you know, Champa. Mm-hmm. With the various other
right.
programs.
How much do private
insurance companies pay for. Pretty much, I would guess everybody in this room has private health care. Well, except for people on Medicare, I suppose, and they may be even, you may even have signed up with a private insurer, like PacifiCare in Los Angeles has Secure Horizons, and so you can sign up and be part of their HMO. So interestingly, Medicare pays for you, but they're really paying a private insurer. But when we look at just the under 65 group and all their dependents and family, how much does private insurance pay for our health care?
50 minutes.
Probably 35.
About 33%. I think most people think it's much greater than that. When we say, oh, you can't have the government be the supplier of healthcare, a single payer system, well, they're already paying 50%. I mean, they're much higher than most people are realizing already. And charity care in our country is about 5%. So charity care, churches, benevolent groups, and this chunk, forgive me, these probably don't all add up, but I'm not rounding down to the percentages. This chunk is out of pocket. We still have 20% of patients having to buy their care out of the pocket. And you realize when we talked a little bit about the fact that there are no discounting schemes going on, there's not big contracts, people not being able to sign, you know, well, I'll bring you my 5,000 employees if you give me a 10% discount or a 20% discount. These people are usually paying the really high prices too. So unfortunately, they don't really get a break.
Does that include the co-pays that go with the private insurance?
Yes, this does. It includes the co-pays and also includes your deductibles.
Does that also include your incidental drugs that you may buy daily at a pharmacy?
The over-the-counter kind.
Actually, it doesn't include over-the-counter drugs, no. That's so hard to tabulate that it's usually not in the figures, right?
So it's not in any of those figures?
No. But it is all pharmaceuticals that are prescribed.
Yeah,
regulated. Yeah.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
Well, the same question.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what percentage is uninsured?
Yeah, in our country, it's 48 million. So what does that make it?
20%.
20% of our population has no insurance at all. That's not Medicaid or private insurance or Medicare. They just have no insurance.
Well, then they're not paying more than their share. 20% are paying out of pocket.
No, you know what it is? They're not getting any care.
Oh, okay.
They're not paying for health care because they're not accessing it. And if they do, then they sometimes will fall into charity care or fall into other government or fall into Medicaid if they spend down their assets. We talked a little bit about this in the access session, but let me just mention, those people who are uninsured are often what are called the working poor, because if you are so poor, you usually qualify for government assistance. But those people, in fact, probably a lot of people here at Holden, recent college graduates who might be making lower or don't have permanent employment, lots of part-time employees, even full-time employees making, say, minimum wage where their company doesn't offer them very good benefits. These people are actually making a living and working.
I guess we'll return more towards the center.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. These people are actually making not a great income, but they're making some income. And unfortunately,
we needed to hit this because it turns up.
Yeah, it actually spins.
Okay.
That's fine, thanks.
Okay,
slide. So anyway, so a lot of these people, unfortunately, what happens to them is that they have no insurance. They basically don't access care. They don't go to the dentist. They don't get their eyes checked. They don't go for the services they need in a preventive fashion. And often they wait until things have gotten completely out of control. And then they access the system much further down the line.
Of course, so the group you just described is among the healthiest in our nation. The college graduates who are working part-time.
Well, I meant a lot of the people here are college graduates, okay. But unfortunately, most of the uninsured in our country, there are a subsection of them that probably are healthy because they're young, but usually it's the lower income, lower socioeconomic status people. And there's a fair amount of sort of research or feeling that these people don't have as good of options for nutrition, for housing, and so their health status isn't actually very good, which is why they end up accessing the system when they have real problems.
the welfare reform, depending on your state, people are being taken off the welfare rolls. It's just beginning now. In 5 years, it's really going to hit the fan. People are going to minimum wage jobs. Those people, depending on your state, may or may not have health insurance. In my state, they do. The other states, they don't.
What's your state?
Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon's interesting. We'll talk a little bit about that when we get to Medicaid. Anyway, so this is where money comes from, all right? So where do you think it goes to, the uses of money? How much of a percentage do hospitals take out of the dollar, out of the total?
Less than
a bunch.
They take a bunch, right. How much do you think?
50.
A little less. About 40%. And we'll talk about this in a second. Contrary to opinion, we're not necessarily dropping real fast. This percentage isn't dropping real fast, and we'll talk about that in a minute. How much do you think physicians get out of the chunk?
10.
No, a little more.
20. About 18.
About 20%.
20.
Then we talked a little bit about the fact that research and development
must be 15.
Actually, they only get about 10%, but as a total, that's still $100 billion. That's amazing compared to other countries. Nursing homes, if you were at our conversation last night, I'm not drawing these lines very well. That's more like it. Nursing homes.
Now you're giving us clues.
Yeah, I know. That's right. I did, didn't I? Nursing homes are 10%. Okay, that is going to go up, or at least if we called this long-term care. Now you've got me standing in a squeaky spot. And these two are what we expect to see, an awful lot of growth. Other personal services, from home health to community-based healthcare services, counseling, whatever the case may be, but other
things, physical therapy.
Absolutely. If it's outside of the hospital or physician realm, right.
Where are prescriptions in there?
That's a good question. I think that what they've done is they've put them through both the hospitals and the other personal services and all. It's not in the R&D. The R&D component is the cost, both the pharmaceuticals and general medical technology. R&D, but not necessarily what's being spent. So if it goes to a hospital pharmacy or a physician prescribes it, it's going to be through there too. Again, just a chance for you to see basically where the money's coming from and where it's going to. Yeah.
Do you have any information on how much people are spending on alternative types of medicine?
That's under other personal, and I don't have a separate, distinct number, no. It's going up, I know that, but I don't know exactly about how much. Yeah, I don't know if you all had a chance to go to the acupuncturist and herbal medicine's talk last night, but it was very interesting, and it sounds to me like it's going to be increasing even faster. Well, so once we have an idea of this, I guess the thing to talk about a little bit is the economic pressure. Everybody knows that there's this pressure on hospitals, this pressure on the entire healthcare industry to curb this growth, to narrow it back down. And a lot of things have started. Managed care, which some people say with a scowl and other people are comfortable with it because they've been living with it for so long, depending on the state or the area you live in, is a very real thing. A lot of people thought it was a passing idea, but it's become a very real thing. And it used to be talked about as a private industry initiative. Market initiative. Well, as you now know, Medicaid is the states have been taking all of their people and enrolling them in managed care. Medicare are pushing people more and more, especially the healthy 65 and overs, because they're better risks, have been pushing them into managed care. So what's happened is managed care is starting to replace our old mentality. So let's talk a little bit about the old mentality. We're talking, I guess, in another class about the fact that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I guess the past generation, people would go in and give birth and they'd be in the hospital how long? 2 weeks? You know, something like that. It's ridiculous. Now they're down to 24 hours. So there's this huge disparity in the way hospital care.
Not in Illinois, they're not.
Going to 48.
Yeah, well, right, there was that push to get it to 24. Now everyone's pushing it back up to at least 48 should be allowed, and if the mother wants.
Well, what's happened to the mentality of healthcare anymore is that the hospital is no longer a place for recuperation for the long term. What it is, it's a very intensive place to have your procedure done. If you even warrant being admitted as an inpatient, you might just need to still be checked in as an outpatient for less than 24 hours. You come in early in the morning, have your procedure done, and you leave, so you're never even admitted. But this has done a couple of very substantial things to the healthcare industry, which is impacting the way it's operating. One, you can imagine that the decreased amount of use of a hospital. We see hospitals either closing, we see hospitals merging, or just decreasing their number of beds in great amounts because they don't have the people filling up these beds and sort of hanging out. Well, the reason I mentioned that the hospital numbers aren't decreasing very fast, the expenditures aren't decreasing very much for hospitals, is that the people who are going into the hospitals are so sick compared to before when they weren't so sick, that the expression the acuity has come up, or in essence they're much more severe. So what we're seeing is, although the numbers of people coming into the hospitals are going down, those who are there are so much more expensive and so much more hard to take care of that they're replacing, the money's staying about the same, that we're seeing a big shift in the kind of care that's being delivered. And they talk about hospitals being turned into these very intense acute care, like ICUs, intensive care units, in mass amounts, because we're keeping all the semi-sick and basically well people out of them, and they're only becoming the very sick, sick places to go. Okay? So we're seeing less people check in. Those who are there are much sicker. And this is impacted and has been impacted by the use of managed care. How would anybody in this room, I guess, define managed care?
Your insurance company decides what procedures you will have and how long you'll be in the hospital and what finally is done. Certainly on the recommendation of the doctor, but it's negotiated. But the doctors will not execute procedures without permission, without permission from
some
sure.
From the payers.
Mm-hmm. Some procedures.
Canada referred to it as veterinary care.
Is that right?
Same way you make the decisions of what happens to your pet. Mm-hmm. Somebody else decides how they're going to manage your health care.
I've never heard that before.
The insurance company contracts with the physician and a price for the service, pick a service. Okay, we're going to do an appendectomy. This is what we will pay given the average cost for your area within a range.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we'll pay for that service. And to get to that service, that doctor has to say, yes, you may have it. You need it. You can go to step two.
And is that the same way you think that they do with the hospital? How would you define the role of the hospital in the HMO?
Or just managed care.
In managed care.
I'm not sure.
But this isn't a test, it's just to see how broad your knowledge is so that Leah knows what she has to feed into you. As far
the hospitals have to cut deals with the HMOs too.
Okay. They're part of the delivery system, but the HMOs are not this faceless entity out there. They are made up of physicians, and they have medical people who are a part of the decision making. It isn't just the bean counters over here making those decisions. There are medical directors, and there are other.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the different kinds of managed care. But basically, the philosophy. You can hear, by the way, in your responses, the anger towards managed care, which is very interesting. People don't hide that. I mean, there is a lot of anger about managed care. The old system used to be called fee-for-service, and in one sentence or two, it's basically when you went and got care, and whatever was billed, it was paid for by your insurer. That's a very simple look at it, but it was called cost-based. As you used it, it was paid for along the way. It's just that simple. You need milk, you go buy milk. You need to have a physical, you go buy it, and you submit your claims, and your insurance company pays for it. Okay, so cost-based. Managed care, the philosophy, the reason this all started was it's a very disjointed way of accessing healthcare. Is anyone paying attention to you in a spectrum of services? Is there any coordination of these services? Your dentist, people have said, it's interesting you say veterinarian care because we have a dog, and our dog gets better reminder slips for immunizations, and it's time for a cleaning, and it's time for this. We don't have anyone saying it's time for you to come in. I mean, your dentist is the closest thing yet to at least reminding you. But there was this feeling that it was all very disjointed. And what if we coordinated the care? What if we got all the providers together speaking to each other? And what if the intention was to keep you well instead of waiting till you got sick and then spending a lot of money after you've had a heart attack versus managing your cholesterol before you even get a heart attack? So that was the philosophy, and everyone thought, hey, that's really great. What ended up happening is the pendulum has swung very, very far over to the other side. A lot of people feel it's coming back to a more reasonable perspective, that everyone is so fed up, there's so much anger, that the consumers are losing, that you can't get the care you want anymore. You can't even have an open, frank discussion with your physician. Remember all those talk about gag clauses? Physicians weren't allowed to tell you that you needed the more expensive treatment when something else could be done for less money. The physicians felt that they'd lost all their power, and that literally the private insurers or the managed care plans were making decisions outside of their responsibility. So, in essence, what has happened is that the philosophy is still there. Let's keep people well. There are lots of different kinds of managed care organizations, and I'll tell you four of them, but there are lots of different kinds, and they're all trying to sort of protect their own strength and responsibility. I hope she's okay.
I think you got a little health care.
She's got an exposed nerve in her throat.
Oh, it makes her cough. Okay, all right, good. I thought she had something seriously lodged. So anyway, what's happened with managed care is that the purchasers, you can't forget your employers in this whole equation. The people who really, really got involved and pushed managed care were people who were buying your healthcare, and that is your employers. And your employers got tired of these incredibly rising costs every single year. So they came together, because the more is better buying power, so they all came together and they said, you know what, if we pool 20,000 people, think of the clout we'll have. We can make the hospitals and the physicians discount their prices for us because we're going to offer them so much volume. So what happened is we got people coming together and the employer saying, you must provide care in total. I'm going to write you a check in total, and you provide care to all our people for a year. That's your problem now. So the key issue in managed care, it was a transfer of risk. All the risk in fee-for-service used to be on the insurers. I could maybe go to the healthcare provider 40 times in a year. There was no way they could say, nope, you've gone too many. Now what happened is that...
The risk was not on the insurer. The risk was on the employer paying the bill for the premium.
Whoever the payer was, the risk was on that because you could use it as ever much you wanted. What happened in managed care is that it shifted around. The payer said, here's your $1 million check for the year. You take care of all my people. If they go over $1 million, you eat the cost. So that's where all of a sudden when you shift that risk around, you shift that incentive around, now everyone said, wow, we've got to rein in people using the healthcare system. How do we do that? We stop allowing them to go to any specialist they want, and everyone has to have a primary care physician. That's a gatekeeper. So they can't even go see a specialist unless they get permission to see one. So all of a sudden there's this holding back, like a damming of access to people. There's saying, you know, why don't you wait 6 months instead of having this third opinion or whatever the case may be, it might go away. So I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there was this ability to stop people's use of healthcare to the extreme that was going on in another fee-for-service industry.
So did it sort of boil down to, in the fee-for-service, profits were made by having patients treated more often, and in managed care, profits are made by having patients treated less often?
Profits of the providers, yes.
Right.
That's exactly right. And the incentives have been literally about-faced. Both in the extreme are bad. In a fee-for-service environment, they would get you to come in as often as possible. You know, this time we'll look at your ear, and next time you come back, we'll look at your mouth. And next
and
time you come back.
Each time you'll have $600 worth of tests.
Yeah.
Well, don't point the finger at the physicians.
No. I'm just saying providers.
Hypochondriacs.
Providers.
At the top of a head.
Absolutely. But when we talk about profits, the profits for hospitals, physicians, physical therapists, yeah. The more we came and accessed the service, the more money they made. And this is why we say the incentive has been completely reversed. Now, the less we access the system, the more of that initial upfront chunk of money they get to keep. But you can understand where it, in philosophy, that sounds like a great idea. Let's keep our people well. If they don't get sick, we benefit. The problem with that is obviously two successive things. One, people are being denied services they might need that are costly. And two, the thing that makes it fundamentally a problem is that an insurer or managed care provider probably isn't going to be responsible for your health care for the next 35 years. So they don't have an incentive to keep you well for 35 years. They don't have that long-term mentality. So if I'm living in LA and the odds, you know, everybody's got an actuary. So they look at me and they say, the odds are she's going to probably switch jobs. She's going to probably move cities. So even though she's insured by us, we're probably only going to have her for 3 years. Why do they have to worry about the heart disease I might have when I'm 65? So this is the complaint, and this is one of the biggest promotions for a single-payer system, is that if we're all insured by the same insurer, that insurer has a lot at stake to keep us all well for many, many, many years. And we talk right now about patient dumping, insurers getting rid of high-risk people. It's because they don't want to spend the money now eating away their profits to keep you well in 20 years. Okay? So that is something that has boiled up and is becoming a very big concern in managed care, is this hopping around to different managed care plans. Because when an employer threatens, I'm going to take my 20,000, like Boeing, I'm going to take my 20,000 or 50,000, whatever it is, employees away from Kaiser, say, and put them into Aetna. Now, Kaiser will lose the volume, but if there's always that threat of not having long-term patients, what incentive do they have to keep these patients well, except for more than a year, 2 years, 3 years at a time? They don't really have to invest in our health, okay? So that's again, I'm getting down to the core, like why does managed care even function the way it does, and what are people upset about? And that is a big argument for single payer, make them all responsible.
The Canada model is a single payer, mm-hmm. I understand, and they deny access. You have to wait. So, you know, that's a trade-off that is a kind of an interesting trade-off. Do you want to wait for your health care? Because they're going to keep you healthy in the long run, but in the meantime, that wait can be serious.
I think it depends, though, on how serious you are. I mean, a lot of people, from what I understand about Canada, a lot of people who are really, really sick and really need an operation, they get it. They get moved up in the line quickly. The problem is a lot of people who think they should have their operation now, where really they can wait 6 months.
But isn't that true in managed care also? People think they need that, but they maybe could wait, but they want it now. Americans want it now.
Right. Mark, do you have a question?
Well, I was just going to comment sort of on the tone. Earlier in the conversation, we were talking about the Canadian system. It was sort of viewed as this negative system, and isn't the U.S. system great? But once we started talking about managed care, that tone switched into, is it ours negative? And I thought it was just really interesting,
right.
Philosophical, sort of psychological subtlety that
right.
was playing in there when ours is great until we start looking at it, and then we see all the
right.
cracks and the...
That's true, and that's, I think, indicative, and I'll just make this comment and then we need to move on. I get all excited talking about managed care, so of course I can go on and on and on about this. It's also indicative to a private market. If you think about the way a private market works, we try one thing and somebody gets rich fast and then that peters out and then you try something else, and we see these very big swings versus a big system policy. that, you know, Canada, Britain, all these other places have tried to implement, and they stick with it, and there's complaints, but they are continuing trying to do this one thing. Whereas managed care becomes the panacea to everybody, and we swung so far that now there's a lot of unrest, and now we're gonna probably swing back and see how we can put the patient first. And there's gonna probably be a lot of complaints with that until we keep swinging, and hopefully we're gonna kind of keep, you know, the momentum's gonna get down and narrower, but a private market, we're going to continue to see these swings wherever the chasing of the dollar goes, you know. So I agree with you. And a lot of people in Britain and in Canada would tell you that their system is great and also that it's horrible. And so you could probably get two sides of the debate there as well.
And I would suggest that through our process, we've seen it. I mean, that is what makes this country what it is. The leader in technology, the leader in everything.
Right.
It's that making mistakes across the middle, both sides, until we find that path.
And maybe we will, and maybe we won't.
I suggest we will.
Yeah. Yes.
Personal story. We just switched this past year from a fee-for-service to an HMO.
Mm-hmm.
Our company offers, you know, either option, because it was going to cost us less, you know, for the coverage, and we thought that we would get, you know, comparable medical service. Now, if experience proves us wrong, it's not too late. You know, we may switch back. We still have that option,
sure.
Which is the great thing about this country. You know?
And to be quite honest, I mean, one final thing is that HMOs and managed care, HMOs in a broad sense, as a proxy for managed care, have really done a lot, cutting a lot of fat out of our system, a lot of overuse out of the system, has really started to refocus people's mind on, you know, I need to use healthcare less, I need to think about my own health, I need to take some responsibility. It's done a lot of very, very good things. We're beginning to experience, the ball got rolling so fast and so much money was cut out. In the first few years of real strong managed care growth, I mean, there were employers saw, you know, their increases either stop. They paid the same amount in the previous year, which is unheard of, instead of 7%, 8% more for healthcare benefits. Not only did they see it sometimes stop an increase, but they even sometimes in California got a reduction. It was like 2% less. So money was saved. People worked smarter. They thought about, let's order only the test this person needs. So there were really great gains made, and to give managed care a lot of credit, you know, I've never had a problem with it. There are problems, systemic problems, that people are trying to address, but it's done a fantastic awakening of our abuse of the healthcare system, and now we hopefully it just won't re-abuse. So having said that, let's talk, yeah.
Can a really sick person that has had a history of cancer, heart trouble, and that, do they have a problem getting into an HMO? Do they deny them access?
Unfortunately, there are a lot of policies that won't allow you to take out HMO insurance, managed care insurance, when you have a pre-existing condition. For 6 months, they make you wait, or your policy is going to be much higher. When your price is much higher, that's not much different than just a regular old insurance product, because you're a bigger risk, so they're going to charge more to care for you. The biggest problem is what is now going through Congress and has passed through Congress, which is a debate in and of itself, is various laws that allow you to switch your insurance company. So if you're with one insurer and you get a different job or you want to switch, they have to accept you, because before people would say, we're not going to accept you and you have a history of whatever. So in some ways they're trying to legislate equity that way. They're trying to say
portability.
That's the term for it, is portability. Your insurance you can carry with you regardless of who insures you. But unfortunately there has become a fair amount of bad press and true stories about people not getting coverage because they had a skin mole and they have, you know, it was whatever, it was cut out, and now they're supposedly a cancer risk. So it's a bad problem, and there really is a lot of legislation trying to stop that. Again, one of the problems that got out of control.
Would that prevent patient dumping as well?
It didn't prevent patient dumping to another insurance company.
But prevent an insurance company from dumping you if you ended up getting cancer.
I'm not sure exactly I'm not sure of that answer exactly. I don't know. I mean, in general feeling, I know that, you know, people lost their insurance coverage because their prices went up so high they couldn't no longer afford it, or whatever the case is, because they have a bad history.
Group insurance is not as affected by that at all, because group insurance,
right, versus individual insurance.
It's an individual
that's
policy.
Right. Sure. Until you try to move on.
Right. Well, but now you, whatever time you've been covered by a group policy, that's the portability. It counts toward the waiting period if you have a pre-existing condition. So
that's right. And that's some of the legislation for gains.
6 or 8 months or 12 months, you've already been insured for that length of time. You have a certificate that says that, and you're right in. Mm-hmm.
Some of your employer contracts also allow you to move directly into something without waiting periods when they write the contracts with them.
Mm-hmm. We never had a waiting period in any of our groups.
Well, you're also insured by CalPERS, and they're one of, aren't you?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, you just have your...
We have Kaiser, Aetna, and a regional HMO lifeguard.
I see.
But, you know, they all allow... No pre-existing conditions are even asked about.
Good. Well, let's talk briefly about Medicare and Medicaid and where those two programs are going. I'm not going to get into all the details about Medicare and Medicaid, who qualifies, what the benefits are. As we mentioned a little bit, Medicare is, both of them were 1965 or started. That's when we saw a huge jump in the money we spent on healthcare. A couple of the ironies that should be pointed out is that the government was in a incredibly strange, like aligning of the stars. We had a Democratic president, a Democratic Congress, and everybody was all together on these social programs. The fact that these two things got passed was sort of a glitch in history, because there have been cyclical efforts to get a social program for both our elderly and our poor many, many times before 1965. And the fact that it came together and worked in this passing was sort of a twist of fate. And it's, if you read, if you're interested in reading the history of that, there's an excellent book I can give you a reference. But it's an amazing thing the way the AMA adamantly opposed any sort of social insurance, Medicare, Medicaid programs. And the minute it was passed and the money came pouring in, all of a sudden they became champions for it, because it turned out to be quite a boon for providers, for hospitals and most everyone, because no longer were there these huge portions of the population that had no insurance. Now these people were being seen, and they had someone, they had the government paying the bill. So although they didn't originally like the idea of social programs, it turned out to be quite a financial boon. The other distinction I want to make is Medicare is social insurance. You pay into it. You qualify for it. It's by age. Everyone, there's not a means test. Everybody qualifies if they've paid in, and it's sort of an insurance program. On the other hand, Medicaid is a means-tested welfare entitlement. Because they're often lumped together, people get them confused, first of all, but also they operate very, very differently. Okay, Medicare is a federal program operated by Healthcare Financing Administration. Medicaid are state and federal programs. The federal government pays a portion. The idea was that they would pay half, but in a state like Mississippi, they pay 83% because the state's so poor they can't afford to pick up the rest. So it's what's called a matching program. The states, however, have the ability to police and make the policies. Think of it as the federal government lays down a basic set of policies, and then the states, for their Medicaid program, can build on top of those policies any way they want. They can set eligibility. So some states are very generous and allow the poverty level to be much lower so more people are covered. Some states are very adamant about what categories, whether pregnant women or the aged or the disabled or blind, who qualifies. So state by state makes a big difference. When we talk about Medicaid, unfortunately, sometimes it is all lumped together, but every state has its own program. Oregon, by the way, has attempted to do a rationing program, a little bit like some of the countries around the world to determine who should get healthcare by an order of preference of services. So they took 400 some services, lined them all up by committee, which is the most dire down to which is the least important. And then they cut off like at 250, they made that line. And so if your need was 251 to 400, the state no longer paid for that. So it was their way of trying to get everyone important healthcare and not so important healthcare they had to pay for themselves. Hasn't turned out to be extremely successful, but it's been a very interesting experiment. Now they can do that because they have the ability to write their own laws.
Well, the other thing we're seeing since the Oregon Health Plan went into existence, I work with Child Protective Services, and all of a sudden poor kids had medical coverage now, and they didn't.
And they didn't before.
6 years ago they didn't. But now they do.
Because they freed up money from other services that they no longer cover.
So
but you can imagine how mad the people are who need the health care that's at 251 and below.
Yeah.
They're furious because they're no longer covered, even if they technically fit Medicaid eligibility standards. So that's one experience. California is trying various things. Minnesota is trying various things. Minnesota is very close to having a completely state-run program for both Medicaid and uninsured people so that everyone in the state has health care insurance. So whatever state you're from, you'll see that it really depends on what that state's policies are, and you'll have a lot more ability to influence by voting and by being involved in the politics as to what kind of health care is given to your state's poor and your state's pregnant women poor, and all of these people we'll be talking more about this week, the specific populations. You have the ability to change Medicaid a lot faster than you have the ability to change Medicare. And in brief, where Medicare is going right now, you've probably all, not up here, but been watching the news and reading the papers and know that there's an effort right now to, Medicare's done everything it can to sort of squeeze the money as much as far as they can, and basically they're doing everything from pushing healthy people into managed care organizations. Interestingly enough, they're losing a lot of money on that because healthy people, healthy 65 and olders, spend less money on healthcare. So they're not using up the resources that were sort of budgeted for them. You're subsidizing those who are very, very sick. And when they get you guys into healthcare HMOs, what happens is they pay a chunk of money to keep you well. The HMOs are getting very rich because none of you are accessing health care like
that's
they expected.
The premiums in California and elsewhere are zero.
Yeah, right. And you don't have to co-pay anything because the government's paying so
much. I don't quite understand what's wrong with that.
The only thing that's wrong with it is that the federal government hasn't been, they haven't used their actuarial services very well. What they've done is the HMOs have gotten real smart, and you see like these advertisements for like the really healthy seniors like walking down the road, and they say, if you're concerned about getting the best health care, join our HMO. They're really trying to appeal for to the 66, 67, 68, because they're very, they're as a whole, they're much healthier than the 85 and overs. So if the federal government pays $500 a month to an HMO, flat fee to keep you well, they're going to benefit by getting in a really healthy 66-year-old who maybe uses $200 a month in healthcare services, versus they're not going to go out and sign up, go into a nursing home where people have a lot of care problems, sign up 85 and olders who are probably using, say, $1,000 a month, and they're still going to get paid $500 a month from the federal government for a managed care contract. So they're what's called cherry picking. They're picking the best and the healthiest of the seniors. And there's that is under the microscope right now at the federal government. They're saying, wait a minute, we didn't think about adjusting for who is going into HMOs. We just said Medicare recipients will get this much money if they go into an HMO, or the HMO will get this much money to take care of a Medicare person. So we're going to probably see a change in that policy. We're going to probably see it be a little bit more tested as to your age, your history, and then HMO is going to be paid accordingly. So we've got that movement going on. We've got potentially an adjustment in the age. There's some talk about bumping up Medicare eligibility to 67 or 70. There's probably not a good chance that Medicare is going to go broke in the next 3 years, as they often say, but there is a concern that it's not going to be properly funded or there'll be less money. The reason it's impossible for Medicare to go fully broke you understand is that every time we get a paycheck, there's a amount taken out, a tax taken out of our paycheck. So there's always money coming in, but the reserves are depleting, and so we're losing our safety net in that program.
That age for Medicare, isn't that, like, I won't draw full Social Security until I'm 65 and 9 months. Not the time I'm just matching it to that, so big
yes.
deal.
Yep. Right. Big deal, but for those people who are 65 and need health care and they might be looking forward to that Medicare, they might not get it if they have to wait a few years.
But if you're still working then.
If you're still working, you're okay. That's right. Well, I'm running out of time. Obviously, I mean, this is a huge subject. This is what sort of makes the healthcare industry go around. And
could you summarize and tell us who is going to pay?
Who is what?
Going to pay?
It's going to change.
The federal government is still going to keep paying, and they're going to keep paying a lot. The states are going to keep paying a lot.
But when am I going to have to start paying?
Taxes.
You're paying. I was going to say, you're paying a lot already, to be quite honest. There's going to be reform. I mean, Clinton's administration in 94 tried to do the health plan. It didn't work, but it got the dialogue going among a lot of people. It introduced some very new ideas that people weren't really necessarily willing to vote on and change about face the healthcare system. But it scared the living daylights out of so many insurers and providers. The thought, again, I can't get into the whole what the health plan was based on, but the thought of the change that was being proposed scared so many people that the private market started making adjustments, which is why we've seen large buyer cooperatives, you know, in Minneapolis, if you live in the Minnesota area, huge buying cooperative came together, Pillsbury and all these people, just as was proposed, interestingly, in Clinton's health plan, that we would have huge buying cooperatives buying health care for large numbers. As we see mergers and acquisitions of large companies, what's happening is our healthcare system is getting bigger and bigger. We're getting alliances, we're getting networks. I may move from Southern California up to Northern California, and in a couple years, I do now have to, but in a couple years, I might not even have to change my insurer because the networks are getting so big. Some people, if you want to be a futurist, some people project that this networking is going to get so big that we're going to have national healthcare companies, we're moving that direction already, national insurers that are so big that you sort of become a Aetna person. And if you like their healthcare, it doesn't matter whether you live in Chicago or whatever, you can sort of get a standardized product and you can live in other places. And we'll probably always have the private market around. We're probably not going to go to a single payer system. But we're moving more and more to the private market, resembling a very big coordinated system.
Interesting. Will that eliminate state health insurance commissioners or state insurance commissioners?
That I couldn't tell you. I'd have to know a lot more about that component, to be quite honest.
Insurance is not the health, it's all that other liability.
If I know anything about California, to be quite honest, I doubt it's going to eliminate it because they are a check and balance against these insurance companies doing things. Or, you know what, any Joe Blow getting into the insurance business, the Department of Corporations in California just won't allow that kind of thing.
And you've got other insurances, auto, life.
Yeah.
Well, we wanted to say thanks for coming this evening. As we've tried to say all this week, the industry itself, the healthcare industry itself, is in a state of flux. And so in answer to this question, there isn't any question right now because the payer system for the healthcare industry is in a state of flux. And as a result, we didn't come with any solutions for this. We came as a look in on the healthcare industry and to let you people react to us and tell the other people that are here about what you know about the industry. And so as a result, if we've generated some discussion about that, some sharing about what you do know, we've accomplished the purpose that we wanted in the short time that it's been allowed to us. So thanks for coming.